Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Boy, we've been talking about it for a number of years, not since 2022 when they made the decision, but leading up to the decision as well. The BLM now has reversed that 2022 decision and allowed the American Prairie Reserve to graze bison on 7 federal allotments. Those allotments were specifically designated for domestic production use, not bison. That is a ruling that the Montana Farm Bureau and the Phillips County Ranchers have sought for years. There's implementation issues with it, but we're going to talk about really what it means for the farmers and the ranchers and the land that they steward. So Scott Kulbeck is joining us here in studio, Executive Vice President of the Montana Farm Bureau's Montana Farm Bureau Federation. We're going to go over this, how it affects the Taylor Grazing Act and how it really affects your grazing rights and your rural community in the future of Montana Ag today on Voices of Montana. The full guest list here in studio today. This will be fun. And then a bit later on, Megan Torgerson is going to join us too. She is, she's got a new documentary out that we'll talk about. The film follows Amber Smith of Cohagen and Jamie Stolfuss of McLeod we'll let her explain that as well. These two ladies have been in agriculture for a lot of years, and there's a lot of work that goes into it, but a lot of memories that come out of it as well. So that'll be a bit later on. Let's welcome our guests in studio. First, to say hello to Colt Brown, who's with us here to kind of talk about this issue. It's a big farm issue. He's director of the Northern Ag Network. Good morning, Colt.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us, and thanks for helping just shine some light on this. It's a complicated issue, hard to grab around, so thankfully we've got Scott here to really help us open it up and explain what's going on here to
Scott
folks.
Scott Kulbeck is Executive Vice President of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Tom, and thank you for allowing me to be here. It's wonderful to be in Billings and to be with you here this morning.
It is. It's really fun to have you in studio because there's just a lot we can cover. I know we've got to get you out of here a little bit early because there's things going on. Labor Summit that you'll want to be a part of. You are a part of, as a matter of fact, with the Farm Bureau Federation. Colter, I'm going to leave it to you to kind of frame this issue and ask the first question. I got a ton of questions. We have covered it an awful lot, but I think this is a vital, vital ruling going forward in our country here.
Well, yeah, I think, and the place to start is probably, well, at the very beginning of when this started. I think it was 2016 or 17 when this proposal first came to the BLM, and I think setting the stage a little bit, and Scott, you can weigh in on this too, but there's sort of an opposition, I think, between the ag community and the American prairie. And it's really just a differing of opinions here, but a lot of farmers and ranchers don't like the idea of taking land out of production, out of livestock production, and putting a conservation herd of bison on there. But private property rights are something that we all value across Montana, so they have the right to do that. But take us to the start of this issue when they asked the BLM for kind of some preferential treatment. Scott, how would you describe what the proposal was that was actually approved?
Sure, and thank you, Colter. Well, going back to the beginning, they were able to get some changes in their allotments in certain areas in Phillips County. And like you mentioned, to be able to graze bison for conservation, but then also they were able to take out a lot of cross-fencing and do some other things that, you know, the normal BLM allottee who's running cattle would not be able to do. And so that was one of the things that first alerted us to this issue, that this is not right. This is outside of what we believe was in the law, the Taylor Grazing Act, and that we needed to do something about it. And about that time, we started really hearing from our Phillips County Farm Bureau members, and they said, you know, it's time to do something about this.
Well, and it's a critical issue for the guys in north central, northeast Montana, and a couple different things packed into that. First, I mean, the law that governs public lands grazing is the Taylor Grazing Act, and it says this land that's going to be used for grazing has to be used for beneficial livestock production, and cattle is the species in there. Bison doesn't even figure in the Taylor Grazing Act.
Yeah, you're right, Colter, and I first want to say, and you mentioned this, and we completely agree, private property rights are one of the foremost things that we believe in, one of our founding principles in Montana Farm Bureau. So what you do on your private land, that's one thing. But as you mentioned, federal land and BLM land is under the authority of the Taylor Grazing Act. And it's very clear in the Taylor Grazing Act that they have the authority to approve grazing allotments for production livestock management. And that's the key to that. And it wasn't only for the benefit of the ranchers who are grazing on that, but it's for the benefit of the communities. And I think that's one of the key aspects of this proposed decision, is that the Taylor Grazing Act is also meant to help those communities by bringing agricultural production and advancing the ag economy, that so many of our rural communities, that's the very fabric of those communities. And when you're raising livestock for production, you've got inputs, you've got families managing, you've got people on those grazing allotments that are looking out for wildfire, that are making sure that that grazing allotment is healthy so that you can get the most out of the money that you're paying for that allotment. So there's so many aspects when you're actually raising livestock for production agriculture that are different than what the APR decided to do on those allotments that were in question.
Well, and we do have a lot of bison in Montana that are raised as livestock. They have a per capita fee paid on them, but this particular herd, I don't think American Prairie has been dishonest about it. They're not raising them as livestock. This is a conservation herd, and that's their goal, which is fine. But that's not the purpose of these the Taylor Grazing Act and these public land allotments. And you talk about the importance of why production matters, because sure, I think that's what really holds a lot of our rural communities together.
Yeah. Well, in this case, and I think, by the way, that this proposed decision was very tightly written, and I think it was brilliant. But they talk about the definition of what the Taylor Grazing Act allows a BLM to do. And they talk about livestock, and in the definition of stock in Black's Law Dictionary, it specifically means that a good that is kept by a merchant for sale or for trade. So that's the key there. And of course, we know what live is, but you put them together and you've got live animals that are kept and raised for either sale or production, or excuse me, sale or trade. Well, what we found in discovery was that when we looked at the APRs and now their American Prairie, their financials didn't indicate a lot of the expenses that the normal rancher would have if you're actually raising livestock or those bison for production. So that was part of that. That was very key. But then you mentioned it, that was in their own information, in their own documents, in their emails. And one of the emails that we found in discovery said that they admitted that they were the only people in the United States that were allowed to change a BLM allotment for grazing of wildlife for conservation. And so that was also key there. But, and that's one of the things that I would say that our farmer members in Phillips County Farm Bureau and all the ranchers up there have really noticed, is that when they take all that land out of production and you don't have the production agricultural costs and inputs that are coming into the community, and you're taking families off of the land, those small rural communities are hurting. And that is also a violation of the Taylor Grazing Act, and that's the very reason.
Well, that's really what keeps those communities strong, and Roy and Winifred and Malta and Winnet is those ranches that are not just spending money in town, but gosh, they're putting kids in the school system. And if we don't have those ranches, what do we have?
Yeah. Like I said, agriculture is the very fiber of most of those rural communities, and we just have to have production agriculture brought back onto the land. And when, like I said, it's their own right to not do so on private land, but public land, that's different.
Well, and I think there's also something here about some of what their request was, you know, to take out fencing and allow for season-long grazing. If a rancher who has a BLM allotment running cattle asks for that, it's a non-starter. Like, no, we're not going to let you do that. So why was there different treatment for this request when we're dealing with conservation bison?
Yeah, I believe part of the reason is just the nature of raising bison for conservation, or bison in general, and that didn't fit the mold. But you're right, it's different land management practices in that instance that were allowed that the average cattle rancher who has an allotment would not be able to do. That's one of the things that I really like about this decision, is that they were re-given their permits, obviously, when this decision becomes permanent, but they're for cattle allotments now, and that's what the decision would say. But it also goes back to being enforceable, them having to have a land management plan, just like any rancher who has an allotment would, and then that land management plan will be subject to approval by BLM, and then they'll have to work with them to make sure that the land is taken care of and the best management practices for the health of land. And so that's part of this decision that I really noticed and I like a lot.
You bet. Well, I know when I looked at it in 2022 when they approved this, it felt to me like we were taking grazing science back 30 years. The idea that we're not going to have cross fencing and we're just going to let them graze on the riparian areas. So I think there's good science here as to why we do what we do, and we have to embrace what ranchers have already been doing and not try to change everything.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Coulter Brown, again, Northern Ag Network Director. It is northernag.net. And from the Montana Farm Bureau Federation, that's pretty easy, mfbf.org. It's Scott Kolbeck, Executive Vice President. Another thing that's real key here about this is not what's happened to the ground, but what happened to the law, because they did this through agency direction. And the Taylor Grazing Act was specifically set up congressionally. And so they created a new category called domestic bison. And for me, that is key as well. Talk about protecting those groups that will do these and run around congressional approval for things like this.
Sure. And just to go back a little bit before the current administration made some changes, if you remember, there was a lot of work within the Department of Interior and the BLM to allow someone to bid on an allotment to use it for conservation.
Right.
And again, against the Taylor Grazing Act and also the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, it also talks about having to graze for production livestock. So not only for, this is important for North Central Montana and Northeastern Montana, but this is important for anywhere in the United States where ranchers are using BLM allotments for grazing, because now the administration right now, they changed that conservation rule that the BLM was proposing, but this also enforces that outside organizations or nonprofits with a lot of money won't be able to go in specifically for the purpose of getting that allotment and then taking cattle off the land and grazing it for conservation.
Scary as heck, yes, is what that was.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what kind of permanent solution does this possibly lead to in that regard?
Yeah. Well, and that's also an important aspect. So thank you for asking that, Tom. Obviously, this is a proposed decision, yeah, and APR, American Prairie, has the right to appeal it, and I'm pretty sure that they will. So we haven't won the battle yet, but we're ahead, and we're gaining ground. If this does become final, and this is the decision that ends up on the book, so to speak, and they have to bring those bison allotments back to grazing cattle, that's really strong. But what I feel like, and what gives me confidence that we will win the battle, is that this proposed decision is strictly based on those laws that give the BLM authority to have an allotment for grazing. And like I said, the Taylor Grazing Act and the FLPMA, which are very specific about having the authority to grant a lease, an allotment for the grazing of production livestock.
You have anything to finish up with, Colter? I know you got to run. We got a breakup coming here as well, and I appreciate you coming in and getting some of these things off your chest as well.
No, I would just echo what Scott said there. Too often when we have these issues with the federal government and trying to get these agencies to take another look at something, we always say, well, we have to codify this. It has to be in the law. The law is already here. We've had the Taylor Grazing Act and FLPMA for decades now. We just need these agencies to follow the law. Yeah. And thankfully, that's what Secretary Doug Burgum has done with this decision.
And this is why I felt all along that this was headed to the Supreme Court one way or the other. I think this move will continue by these conservation groups. Coulter, thank you for stopping in. I know you got a busy day as well.
So, thanks for having me, Tom.
He is a director of the Northern Ag Network. They do like 17 broadcasts a day. It might feel like a million to them sometimes. There's a lot of news going on. Catch it all at northernag.net. Going to have a story a bit later on, a short documentary that actually is going to make its world premiere at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival upcoming in February. Mother Range is the name of this. Yes, it follows the story of a couple of maidens of our Montana agriculture and our rural values. And Megan Torgerson will be with us here of Reframing Rural. All right, with Scott Kolbeck, he's in studio here for another few minutes with the Montana Farm Bureau Federation, mfbf.org. For more information, Executive Vice President, 20,000-plus Montana farmers and ranchers represented in this. And we're talking about this decision to resend the permits that I felt were controversially and illegally awarded to American Prairie Reserve in 2022. Got a lot of background on that. I appreciate that. I want to know kind of maybe what we're missing here. And some of my comments are, you know, we talk about these conservation groups. They have different management practices, but they also have different acquisition practices too. They, in my mind, that nonprofit status for a group that is funded in the tune of $1 billion you know, available to them when they need and when they want. Yeah. That is not a level playing field, Scott.
Yeah, Tom, you're exactly right, and the numbers you throw out, those are mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And you know, they are a nonprofit organization, so they can attract a lot of donors who have a little bit of a philanthropic philosophy, but then also can throw huge money and then get a lot of tax advantages out of that. So it's not exactly fair when, and again, willing buyer, willing seller, we're all for property rights, but when they can throw numbers at, you know, a rancher or a farmer, like a person who was wishing to buy that property for production agriculture can't compete with, then it's not a level playing field. You're right.
They own 167,000 acres through these purchases, right? And again, well over $100 million went into those purchases. They control 600,000 acres. Part of these are these seven federal allotments now that's going to be rescinded in this as well. They have desires for 3.2 million acres in Montana. So a very, very large landowner in our state, and not one that has roots in Montana. What's next? What happens to these seven allotments?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're getting a lot of questions into our Farm Bureau office about that exactly. And so from what I understand, the ruling came out last Friday, January 16th. American Prairie has 15 days from that date to decide to appeal. And I would imagine that they will. So after that, it'll go through the appeal process and we'll get bogged down a little bit. But another question that we're getting asked a lot is what happens to those allotments since they're canceled? Well, you know, it's very important and for all of our members who use BLM allotments that those allotments are tied to base acres. So those allotments will still belong to American Prairie. But according to this proposed decision, they would have to go from bison management for conservation to cattle, put cattle on those grazing allotments and raise them for production agriculture.
How many acres are we talking about in those seven allotments?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess I don't have that right in front of me, but you know, it is quite a little bit of what they're running up there.
What would it be? 400,000 maybe total? Because they control 167,000, they own, and they say they control 600,000 right now. That doesn't matter. It's a large track of land.
Yeah, it is.
And the precedence here, I think, is really important, Scott.
Yeah, it is. And you know, and just like one of the allotments here, the Flat Creek allotment, you know, what they will be able to run is, you know, I think 1,222 AUMs. So that's a large allotment.
Wow.
White Creek, you know, is another 1,862 AUMs, so we're talking about large tracts of land.
What are AUMs for?
Oh, yeah, animal units per month.
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Yep.
There's, do you have anything else to say? I know we do, and this will be an ongoing kind of thing going on. I do want to move to the rail merger because I know that's a huge issue for ag as well. Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern have proposed to join together. There's been a lot of talk about it. There have been a number of groups that have opposed that for a lot of reasons. One of them is the controlling interest of that particular railway. It would be, as I recall, 40% of all track in the country. And what are we doing with our monopoly laws if this happens, right?
Yes, very important. And I think you're right about that 40%, but in certain industries, such as the transportation of chemicals and steel and also timber, they would have over 50% of the market. And so what this merger would do is it would leave us with one national rail carrier and a couple of regional rail carriers. And one of the things that I find most troubling about this is that out of the Pacific Northwest, roughly 75% of the wheat that is transported for domestic use will end up going east and end up on UP, Norfolk Southern Rail. So what we're afraid of, obviously, is that they will be able to charge higher rates for BNSF or anywhere else that we use to carry that grain to our domestic markets. They're paying somewhere over in between $10 and $18 billion above market value to gain Norfolk Southern. So where's that money going to be made up? It's going to be made up on captive shippers in those markets that I mentioned, and then also on Montana and Pacific Northwest grain producers who are shipping their product east for domestic use.
Now, we think of rail. It is a utility. It's a regulated utility, but it's not regulated like we understand energy and the Public Service Commission. Can you impose some kind of regulation? Or would they propose some kind of regulation that will say, hey, look, we're not bad players. We're going to do this. But then, you know, down the road, that goes away.
Yes, sir. Sure. And it is under the authority of the National Transportation Board, which is a good thing. And we've been before the National NTB before proposing rules with other railroad mergers, is that is very important. What we found out was, you're right, they will say that we'll act in this way, but when their past merger for UP down south, they haven't lived up to those agreements. And in fact, there's still ports where we cannot get our products out of because of they're slow to act in those agreements. Now, good news for us, and also came out on Friday, is that the Transportation Board actually denied their application because of some errors in the application. Okay. But that's just a temporary thing. They'll fix those, and they'll come back with that rail merger application to the National Transportation Board.
What would that do? I mean, I already see during good years grain just laying on the ground. Yeah. You know, what is the transportation issues that our ranchers and farmers have?
Well, right now, grain producers, I don't have to tell anyone out there, are having a hard time. Yeah. You know, they're losing money raising grain, even lentils. And one of the biggest reasons why is the high input costs. And one of the, you know, shipping is a big input cost. And so, you know, every farmer out there is looking at that basis daily. And if this were to go through and they've got the ability to then make up that $10 to $18 billion, like I mentioned, on captive shippers, that's going to affect the input costs of our farmers and ranchers right here in Montana.
Scott Kolbeck again with us here with the Montana Farm Bureau Federation, MFBF.org. If you got more thoughts on this, you know, please go to them. But you just came back from a national convention, the American Farm Bureau Convention as well. Give us a sense of, you know, how big is this issue for them? And then how's everybody doing?
Yeah, it is a big issue. And in fact, we were able to get our resolution, and it's an interorganizational resolution to have American Farm Bureau oppose this rail merger. So that was big for us. Overall, I'll tell you, you know, we have a lot of cattle members, cattle growing members, and they're seeing some opportunity now to pay off some previous debts because of so many poor years and drought years, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But overall, our farmers are hurting nationwide quite a little bit now. The FBA, or the Farmer Bridge Assistance Act, that's going to put some good money into Montana for our farmers, but it's not going to cover all the losses. And so one of the things that American Farm Bureau came out of that meeting with is that we have to do more. We have to push for a farm bill. We're actually pushing for some more assistance to help those farmers in parts of the nation that are looking at making a tough decision whether or not to even be able to go to the bank and get a operating loan, to hopefully have them stay into business and get them through another production cycle. And then some of the things that passed with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
OBBBA,
yeah. Such as higher reference prices, those will actually come into play then in the fall of 26. And so we need to figure out a way to get our farmers through that to that point.
Scott, I think we've seen over the years, and I got just like a minute left here, we've seen a lot of organizations grow their awareness and their messaging. And I think that has helped. I think it's helped people understand this issue with American Prairie Reserve, certainly the rail merger. You've got a leadership conference as well. I mean, you continually have to educate and train.
Yes. And one of the things I'm most proud about within our organization is what we've invested in our Young Farmer and Rancher program. And they've got a Young Farmer and Rancher Leadership Conference up in Great Falls at the Holiday Inn. It starts out this weekend, Friday night. There's still room for people to come and just sign up at the door there. Again, it's Holiday Inn, but they've got a lot of great speakers, and one of the things that's best about that is that networking opportunity for young people in production agriculture, where they get a chance to feed on optimism of their peers and then also learn from their peers and ask a lot of good questions.
Especially for small producers, you don't have to be the biggest one out there. The average farm size of Montana is like 2,400 acres. Maybe take that in this weekend. Yep. Montana Farm Bureau Federation, again, mfbf.org for more information. Scott, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Appreciate that. We'll talk to you again, okay?
Sounds great.
That's Scott Kolbeck. And Megan will join us next here. Megan Torgerson, Reframing Rural on Voices of Montana. Great to have you joining us. Thank you for making us part of your Montana Day, two decades strong and working on three. Hello to friends in Glendive, KDZN 96.5. FM. Good station, good music off of that, and good talk as well. And a special thank you to our friends in Billings, KGHL, right next door, 790 AM and 94.7 FM. Thank you guys for listening. As we get on, we're going to tell a story. We're going to tell a Montana story, right? Maybe even a couple of stories. And stories upon stories comes out of things like that. That's one of the fun things we get to do on this job is to talk about people, not talk about them in a bad way, but to encourage them in a good way. And I think that, you know, when you go back, well, let me welcome our guest and we'll have her go back and talk about this story. Mother Range documentary. Congratulations. It is going to be premiered, the world premiere at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. Not a lot of films make that film festival. I think there was 2,000 submitted. Megan will tell us that, and only 115 get chosen. So congratulations. And Megan is Megan Torgerson, a Montana writer, farmer's daughter, documentary producer, and also does Reframing Rural, which is a award-winning podcast. Hello, Megan. How you doing?
Hi, I'm wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on. It's exciting to be on the airwaves with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Storytellers, tell us a story. Yes. And this one is going to feature a couple of people that first-generation Montana ranchers and mothers.
Yes, so the film that we have premiering at Big Sky Doc Fest, as you mentioned, in February, is called Mother Range, and it features two moms and first-generation ranchers, Amber Smith of Cohagen, Montana, and Jamie Stoltzfus of McLeod. And if you aren't familiar with Cohagen or McLeod, although I'm sure some of your listeners are, Cohagen is just north of Mile City, and McLeod is just south of Big Timber. And so they have a really unique partnership where Amber raises calves on her ranch, Antelope Springs, and then they're sent over to Jamie's ranch outside of Big Timber, and they're finished on grass there, and then Jamie sells the beef through her meat company called Cowgirl Meat Company. And that's the film that we have kind of shares their journey in becoming ranchers and how motherhood has shaped them also throughout this journey. And really, I see that as first-generation ranchers, they're kind of unburdened by expectations of what ranching might look like if you came from a multi-generational operation. So they're really freed up to explore alternative approaches like partnering and then selling direct to consumer. So that's the doc that we have that's coming out in Missoula on February 22nd at 1 p.m. at the historic Wilma Theater. It's a real honor to be sharing our film at that theater, and I'm a University of Montana alum and used to volunteer at the festival. So to be able to share a film with that audience is just a true honor. I'm really excited.
Yeah. I mean, and I remember this was like, well, it was the 20th anniversary of the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. I was living in Missoula at the time, and we did that. They do a wild walk parade. I mean, they do it up well in Missoula. But yeah. I mean, that was 20 years ago or whatever. I mean, that festival is a premier festival in the inland Northwest, if not the entire country.
Yes, definitely. It brings together 25,000 festival goers across the whole week. And fun thing, it's always over my birthday week too, which I really love. But it's a really great film festival to be part of. And yeah, it's in its 23rd year now. So it's really has a strong history in the West and beyond.
Share some more out of this documentary, out of this story. What was compelling? You noticed some things that were compelling. Maybe go into that a little bit more. The fact that they're first generation Montana ranchers as well. You know, how do you see that? What differences can you note from first generation Montana ranchers to maybe fifth generation Montana ranchers?
Sure. And I'm a fifth generation Montanan myself.
And well, there you go.
Farm and ranch. Yeah. In Dagmar, Montana. So near Medicine Lake, Plentywood, Sydney area. And so it's different in that, you know, how my family operated. We have our family homestead. You know, my dad expanded from there, and he just retired a few years ago, but my cousin's leasing out the farm and ranch now, but had a traditional, you know, dryland wheat farm, cow-calf operation. And how Amber and Jamie got into the industry was a lot different. Both of their husbands actually grew up on family operations themselves, but they didn't have places to return back to. And Amber and Jamie independently also found a love of ranching. But they don't own any of their own ground, so they lease all of the land that they run their ranch on. And they have a really interesting partnership, especially Jamie in McLeod with the landowners there, and they're really wanting to use that land as part of their stewardship goals. And they collaborate really in running that herd, and they've been really supportive of that operation. But they're really having to innovate, you know, without having family lands to fall back on. They're having to think outside of the box. And the film tells that story. It also, you know, really addresses the fact that today most Montana ranchers, of course, they aren't selling direct to consumer. And some places you can't even do that because you would be so far removed from cities like Bozeman or Missoula where you could sell your meat directly to people. I'm sure you've heard this statistic before, but the percentage that ranchers receive for every consumer dollar spent on beef in the grocery store is only 37 cents. So on every dollar that you spend on beef, only 37 cents of that dollar goes to the producer. Through that direct-to-consumer market that Jamie is accessing through her meat company, Cowgirl Meat Co., they're able to circumnavigate that and receive more money back on the consumer dollar back.
Yeah.
So those are kind of some of the themes that we're addressing. But it's really a poetic and slow-moving film that really lets you absorb the landscapes of the beautiful Great Plains and the Absaroka Mountains.
Yeah, yeah, why not? I mean, you're going to film it in Montana, put people here through, vicariously. Is Megan Torgerson again with us here? Mother Range documentary is what we're talking about here, but she's also well-known for a podcast, founder of Reframing Rural as well. A couple of things, and maybe this is... this direct-to-consumer approach now, how big can it get in your mind? How prevalent, how much will it help, I dare say, save the Montana rancher and farmer?
Yeah, I really think it depends on your geography. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I don't think a rancher who grew up in the far northeast corner where I grew up would be able to access these markets mm-hmm. because they're so far removed from large city centers and farmers markets and those things. Jamie is lucky enough to be close to Bozeman, close to Big Sky, but she also ships her meat all across the country. One of the conundrums that she has is really figuring out how many beef do they process? Like how much meat do they need to sell? Like it's really hard to tell how many customers they're going to have each year. And oh, if they, harvest too much, then they have too much in the freezer, and that's a whole issue too. And they've really, so we started working on this film in 2023. It's now 2026, and they figured out a lot of that marketing strategy since then. But it was an issue at first to figure out how much do we need and how big of an audience do we need to sell this meat to. But I was really honored to be invited into this film project. I am a documentary podcast producer, so I've only worked in audio until Anthony Pavkovich, who is the film's director, and he has been telling stories about family agriculture in Montana for many years. And Anthony and his collaborator, Zach Altman, who works for Western Landowners Alliance, and he's also a podcast producer and a filmmaker. And they invited me on because of my family roots in agriculture and also the many years that I've spent telling stories about family agriculture through Reframing Rural. So it was really a learning curve to shoot film. And also in the editing process, it's a lot easier to call someone and get a little bit more audio you need for a story, but you can't easily just go back to the place where you're shooting film to capture a calf being born or whatever you're kind mm-hmm. of looking for to make the story complete. So it's been a really fun learning process for me too, to be part of this.
You noted that there were some advantages to not, to being first generation, not maybe necessarily having that institutional knowledge or way of doing things. What were some of the disadvantages that you found maybe that they encountered without that institutional knowledge of ranching?
Well, the operation that Amber Smith is on is now up for sale, and we learned that after the film was completed, that might have been an interesting twist. Mm. But she's at the at the mercy of people who are buying land. Whether they're interested in conservation, that's kind of the thing that Amber's the landowners for Amber and Jamie are more interested in than, you know, buying land for hunting or what have you.
Development.
But
exactly.
Yeah. So Amber, I'm not sure what their next steps are going to be, but that, you know, that's the risk. If you don't own the land, something could happen to it. And so for Reframing Rural, I just finished the fourth season, which is called Succession Stories. And on the other end of things, all the families that I interviewed for that season were multi-generational operations. And really, you know, they have a whole other set of challenges working with family to try to pass the operation down, you know, figuring out if it's going to be large enough to bring a kid or two back into the fold. And so it's interesting to be working on these two projects at the same time, where you have first generation ranchers on one hand in the film project, and then multi-generational producers through that podcast season, which is really encouraging people who are from those family legacies to take the time to make a succession plan, as it's something we're really seeing is keeping agricultural land in the hands of family farmers.
Yeah, we're gonna take a break now and come on back and explore that more too. What does it take for rural communities to remain viable in our modern economy? Megan Torgerson has wrestled with those thoughts and others. A farmer's daughter, born and raised near Dagmar, Montana, and now we're talking about this Mother Range documentary that will premiere here next month. With Megan Torgerson, Mother Range is this documentary, again, premiering at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. This will be February 22nd and at the Wilma Theater. Take this one in. It's world premiere as well. Megan, thanks again for being here. As we talk about, you know, thanks for talking about this documentary here and who it features. It reminds me, and you were talking about Succession as well, time goes so fast, just got a couple of minutes here, but it reminds me that these two are entrepreneurships, and there is a real entrepreneur spirit, I think, in agriculture, especially when it comes to our youngers, so to speak. So succession planning is a big part of that.
Absolutely, yes. So in my podcast, Reframing Rural's new season, it's all about succession stories. We have five families who are, you know, they're all very entrepreneurial themselves, and the next generation is coming in and having to innovate to keep some of these farms and ranches going. One of the families from the season, and you can find Reframing Rural at reframingrural.org, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. So the Baruski family from Eagle Eka, they were a farm and ranch, but they had 1 year that their crops were so poor. They had hail and drought that they only hauled a few semi-loads of grain off of their place that year, all the way to Pompey's Pillar, which was very far from Ekalaka. So, you know, really in the red looking at that farm year. And they, the youngest, the son, Ryan Bruski, who's in his early 30s, he studied under Gabe Brown out of Bismarck, North Dakota, and was learning about different approaches to regenerative agriculture. And they took a risk, and they reseeded all of their farm ground back into grass. And now they're so successful that they have, I think, seven hired hands, one from South Africa, multiple people who are locals. They have built off-site out of their you know, farmyard an office space, and they have even a space where their hired hands can live. So they've really turned around that business. And that's just one of the stories from the succession season. One favorite that people are really enjoying listening to is with Gene Curry, the former president of the Montana Stock Growers Association and current chairman of the Montana Department of Livestock. And Gene runs Curry Cattle Company in Valier, Montana, on the Rocky Mountain front. And he grew up in a grocery store, so his parents were entrepreneurs in that regard. But he really wanted to be a rancher his whole life. And he worked in trucking for a long time, enough to build up a big enough ranch for his two sons to come back home to. That was the dream. But then they later discovered that it really was most viable to have one son coming back. But Gene's story really shows the value of communication and of vulnerability in working with your family to create a plan for the future of your farm and ranch. And he was really, really vulnerable, and had a wonderful interview with Gene. Just loved getting to meet the Curries and all the families in the season.
Megan Torgerson, thanks for sharing. I appreciate that. And again, Mother Range documentary coming out, and look for the Reframing Rural podcast as well. Thanks, Megan. Have a good one, okay?
Thank you. You too.
Yeah, we'll talk to you down the road. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.